Welcome back to another episode of the Brown Body Health and Fitness Podcast. Joining me today is Dr. Kyle Richmond. Kyle is a doctor of chiropractics, and him and I are going to be discussing mobility training. So things like stretching, active mobility, we even hit on manipulations, foam rollers, all that kind of stuff today. So it's probably not the kind of take that you're expecting from the two of us, but really great episode with some real honest, open thoughts about mobility training and how we believe it should be done. This episode and every episode in season 5 is sponsored by ISOFIT, my go-to for all things isometric training. For more on them, you can check the description below. Enjoy. Kyle, welcome to the podcast. I'm super excited to work with you today, man. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
For people who might not be familiar with you or all the amazing stuff you do from a chiropractic standpoint and online on social media, would you mind filling them in a little bit about who you are and all that you do?
For sure. So I am a chiropractor, which a lot of people don't know based off my social media because I don't really promote that a ton. Everyone knows what a chiropractor is. They always have this preconceived notion of like, you adjust people, you send them home. I treat more from almost like, I hate to say like the physical therapy aspect, more of the exercise base, right? Patient-centered care, get them moving, get them doing things. And when I graduated school, I had no idea. I was like, I'm probably not gonna do social media. This stuff's silly, blah, blah, blah. Well, I started falling in love with like FRC, the mobility-based things. I'm like, you know what? I'm gonna start posting this stuff because one, it was cool to do and it showed people I do something a little different, right? Immediately go, okay, you do mobility stuff. What is this? Versus if I just post people getting adjusted, most people only want their next touch, let alone adjusted. So you're like, this is an easy way to show people. Again, I say my social media is like my portfolio. Kind of shows a little bit of what I know, what I can do. Because most people also don't know that chiropractors can treat more than just the spine. Like, oh, you work with shoulders and hips and knees? Yeah, so it was easy. And I did not expect social media to blow up the way it did, which allowed me a bigger platform to then go out and open my own clinic and do my own thing. And now have all these crazy connections. The only reason I'm sitting here right now talking to you is because of social media. So yeah, chiropractor by trade, treat more of the exercise-based model. I still do the passive modalities, adjust, scrape, tape, all those great things, but heavy emphasis on teaching the patient, hey, here's what you got to do.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. And I think that's something that I really respect about you, Kyle, is, you know, we kind of put money in stock in the things that really move the needle forward and things that people can do on their own, right? Like, you know, people might not be able to adjust themselves, but they can do exercises on their own. And ultimately, we want to get to a system where, you know, people might not have to come and see me 3 times a week in order to feel better, right? Like, we kind of give them a little bit of like autonomy back, for lack of a better way to put it.
Yes. And that's the thing. I think a lot of chiropractors or physicians in general are scared to have that patient leave their door, right? But I know if I do a really good job treating their spine or let's say low back pain, you know, people are going to have pain again in life. That's how it is. They're going to come back for their shoulder. They're going to pack for their knee. They have a relapse of pain in their back. If you do a great job and you treat them very efficiently and teach them things, one, they're going to tell everybody, and two, you become their person, right? I have people that come in a handful of times throughout the year for different issues, and they keep coming back. And not that I want to build my model off, like, I need you coming back, but they trust you then. And that's the beautiful thing versus saying, hey, you got to come here 3 times a week forever. That's the typical chiropractic model. It's like, hey, you're going to sign up for 24 visits. If I saw a patient 24 times in the first like 2 months, I know I'm not doing something right, you know? Everyone's time is valuable. My time is valuable. We're probably just running the same cycle of stuff over and over. So yeah, I think that's a big fear for people is, hey, like if I teach people what to do, they'll never come back. And I that couldn't be any further from the truth.
I think that trust piece that you just hit on is absolutely essential. And you had mentioned earlier that, you know, mobility training has been something that you've really gravitated towards with emphasis on the FRC principles that way. And it's funny because I feel like mobility and trust have been two things that kind of go hand in hand, but specifically with the athletic population. I have so many athletes that come in to see me for PT and they say, hey, well, you know, everyone's told me I'm tight. You know, my coach, you know, my trainer, all these different people just tell them they're tight. And that's like, I start moving them and I'm like, no, you're like wicked lax. Like, I can't move my hip like that. I can't reach, you know, the ranges that you do. But then I strength test them and they're all very weak, especially in those end range type positions. And it's very, I'll say it's a challenge to get that trust from someone when everyone has told them they're tight. Everyone has told them that they just need to stretch more, that mobility is their problem. But in reality, I think most of the time, a lot of these kids have more than enough mobility. They just don't really know how to use it, for lack of a better way to put it.
No, you're exactly right. I'd say 99% of the kids, athletes, high school, even up to college level, they're not crazy stiff. You can move them. They're very flexible, but their mobility isn't great. I'd say their control and their strength is what is lacking. Most sports, they're not moving towards their end range of motion. We, as even as strength coaches, I have a problem with, they load these kids up in heavy back squats. They don't trust this weight and they move a third of their range of motion. So now they're only reinforcing that mid-range stuff. They don't get to end range. They don't strengthen that stuff. They don't spend time learning control, how their hip moves, how their shoulder moves. Everything is in this small little bubble. And then they're told you need to stretch more, need to do this. And I think stretching is something that there's a very small time and place for. I think it's more for a therapeutic relaxation, meditative thing, maybe to prime tissues, you know, but in terms of like you're stiff, 9 out of 10 times is not, we need to stretch more.
Right, right. So if it's not a stretching more to solve stiffness or, you know, that kind of tightness feeling, then what do you feel people should be doing instead?
And this is where I go to like the FRC end range control stuff is I'll say, hey, you have a hip that I can internally rotate it crazy. I say, you go ahead and do that motion. They can't move the hip more than 5-10 degrees. You go, okay, let's fill in this other space with active control. Let's teach your brain that you can use this stuff. So it won't grab on and become all that stiff tenses because it's almost trying to protect you because it knows if you move into that range of motion, you're not strong there. The risk of injury goes up. The risk of complications are way higher. So we have to break things back down and I'll take them through a full joint assessment. Like, let's check your passive versus your active motion. Let's fill those gaps in. And then I reinforce that with a fuller range of motion compound lift, right? Like, let's get your hips moving better. Okay, now let's have you go back squat. And now you're starting to trust that range of motion. You know, not everything has to be move as far as you can on a bench press and a squat, but let's use a majority of it or make it more specific towards whether it's your sport or hobby or whatever it might be. We have to fill that whole range in.
Yeah, I love that approach. And I mean, it kind of opens up the door for a conversation about what we're actually doing with exercise and why we feel what we feel in the first place, right? Like, I think a lot of people are convinced everything we do as clinicians is biomechanical in nature. Like when we are stretching the TFL and IT band complex, they literally think we're lengthening it. And it's like, do you know how much force is actually required to like lengthen the IT band? Like, good luck.
Right.
Or when we do that cavitation, you know, everyone seems to think that, you know, we're magically, you know, putting their hips back into position or something like that. And it's like, you know, a lot of times that's not the case at all. It's more of we are doing a neurophysiological reset, for lack of a better way to put it. But the same is true from an exercise standpoint is not everything we do is meant to increase your muscle bulk. And not everything we do is going to like magically change how your, you know, joint capsule works. It's just going to change how you feel and how you're moving as a result.
Right. Like I can use manipulation or stretching, whatever, to, hey, I can give you that more range of motion temporarily and it's less exhausting on you and your physiology. So you save more energy to go do these other things, right? You can do most of the stuff by yourself at home, but an adjustment temporarily opens up that space for now us to go train that to make your body understand that's okay to have, right? So they can do all these things on their own, but we're there to help facilitate all of this. I think that's the biggest thing. They're not reliant on us. Most of these things they can do, but we hold the framework and the key for them to understand why and what they're doing, right?
Yeah, no, definitely we do. And it's funny because a lot of these terms we've thrown around, they almost get used interchangeably, right? Like stretching, range of motion, mobility. It's like, well, you know, I can see why they get confused, but in reality, they all mean slightly different things. Like stretching is, hey, I can put you there. Range of motion, we have the passive versus the active. Mobility, it's like, to me, that makes me think of the movement that they can achieve on their own. So really just kind of like trying to clear up this space where there's just so many misconceptions, I feel.
I agree. Everyone just throws mobility at everything and they grouped everything that's stretch, band related, you know, distraction, anything like that is just grouped into one thing. Then people, if you can't define what you need, then we don't know what we're doing. We're just throwing stuff at a dartboard and hoping that something sticks. We have to say, Do you need more flexibility or passive motion? Great. Here's all the modalities we can do for that. Do you need active strength and control? Well, here's the modalities for that. Once you've defined that treatment and their results are astronomically higher. But if I have a kid, like you said, who thinks they need to stretch more because their hamstrings are tight, they can go stretch 10 minutes a day till they're blue in the face. All of a sudden you go, hey, let's maybe just load you up and get you into those deeper positions, control stuff. And then their results go to the moon. They skyrocket.
Do you feel the conversation about things like stretching and mobility changes at all in relation to sports that require hypermobility, like your dancers, your gymnasts, that sort of thing? Where does the, I'll say like the focus change for those types of, you know, demanding activities?
That's a great question. We look to see what are the prerequisites their sports need. Like a baseball pitcher, right? He needs to have an insane amount of external rotation. So if I can't passively get him there, yes, maybe we get more to, well, again, if I can't get him there through some isometrics and loading to gain more range of motion, then I do need to put some stretching stuff in to gain that passive motion and then fill it in. So it all comes down to what does that person need? I get people come in like, you know, I need more passive external rotation in my shoulder. You take them like, holy crap, look how much you have. And you go ahead and lift your arm off the table. And they're like, this doesn't budge. You're like, okay, well, we've defined what that is. But again, certain sports require different things. I have a swimmer currently I'm working with, and she needs an insane amount of shoulder flexion, extension, everything like that. I can't just bring her to what I deem as a normal amount. She needs more than that. But then also we have to have, do you have the control there? I can get your arm to this crazy position, but can you do it yourself? That's where I kind of, you know, put people in those two buckets.
Kind of setting the ground of first, we need to be able to get there. And second, once we get there, we need to have the strength and control in that position. Now, you mentioned that you leverage FRC a lot for this. And I think the pales, the rails, the liftoff, the hovers, there's a lot of different terminology around here. What kind of, for people who aren't familiar with it, what kind of principles underlie FRC and how do you go about applying them clinically?
Oh, that's a good question. So you'll see a lot of things. Cars are controlled articular rotations. I call it, it's a big joint circle. It's a way to move your joint to its fullest capacity. I can use it as an assessment. I can use it as a training. I can use it as a passive modality. I can do it for somebody. Your pales and rails are your isometrics. It's a way to load the joint without moving it. We can use that to either build strength and range of motion, gain more range of motion. You have your hovers and liftoffs, more your dynamic control things. Okay, I need to get you to move into these positions. I started to really fall in love with the FRC principles and mindset because it was super scalable, right? I can take this from 10 years old to 90 years old in some capacity. And it seems like mobility training is a very low threshold to get people to do, right? I'm not sending someone home with, hey, you're going to go do RDLs. Like they might not even own dumbbells or know how to do that. But if I say, hey, you're going to go home and do this lift off, it was a lot simpler for them. They can understand that it's a little bit, I hate to say the word safer, but it's a lower barrier to entry. They don't have to have as much force and outside constraints on them. So even just a car is so simple, but it's very scalable. I can have someone doing it from like really post-op, like I just need to make a really small circle of your joint to you're a high-level athlete. I'm going to have you holding on to a lightweight and training it through a lot of time under tension. So there's a lot to go into each of these categories, but the nice thing is it all comes together as long as you have that assessment of what do they need. I see a lot of people have never taken an FRC course. And they start throwing cars at people and pales, rails, and they're like, well, nothing's happening. Like I'm not getting the results because you don't know why you're putting that there, right? It's like saying someone like, oh, you have tight hips. Let's just go get you to squat. Well, why? What is the squat doing? Why are you squatting? What part of the squat needs to be improved? So FRC also breaks it down a lot more. I can take it by a joint by joint approach, which is nice as a chiropractor because people want you to really hone in on something versus be like, all right, come on over here and let's just squat. So I don't know if that answers.
Yeah, no, definitely. There's a lot to unpack there. And first off, you know, kind of backtracking a bit, I love your approach on joint by joint instead of just global. You know, I think a lot of practitioners and even, you know, strength coaches, athletes, that sort of thing, we like to look at the whole movement, right? Like, hey, someone's not squatting well, we need to fix their squat. And it's like, well, maybe we should just dive in a little bit deeper and say, well, why are they not squatting well? Well, is it their hip? Is it their knee? Is it their ankle? Yeah. Is it all of them? Or is it something else entirely different, right? Like, instead of just saying, well, you know, they're not doing this well, okay, let's fix that. I feel like we need to ask more why questions. And the more you ask that, the more layers you're going to uncover to the problem, first off. And second off, I feel like if you can actually get to that why things are painful, why it feels a certain way, whatever, your success rate is going to be so much higher because you're a lot more specific in what you're actually working on, as opposed to, hey, you know, squat's painful, so we need to fix the squat. And then you just throw random squat correctives you found on Instagram at them and get nowhere.
A lot of people like drag me through the dirt for me, like, oh, we don't need to isolate. Isolate's stupid. Everything works together. It does work together, but if I can isolate it, essentially fix that problem, and then teach you how to integrate again, that's awesome. Let's say someone has a terrible squat that's painful or whatever. We break down all the joints, hips, knees, spine, ankles, whatever, and we don't find really anything. There's no real big deficits here. Well, maybe it's just an overall motor control issue, which is awesome. But if that's not the problem, they have a major lack of hip internal rotation on the right side. You can't see that just by the squat, but I could see it on a table test. Go, well, look at this. And all of a sudden you improve that. You're going back to the squat and the squat's better. So I like the whole idea of isolate, then integrate, right? It's much more simple than just like throwing a bunch of corrective exercises for a compound movement. That's why I didn't really vibe much with I think it's FMS, is like, let's just have them do an overhead squat. Most people can't overhead squat to save their lives. And if you tell me they failed that squat, how are you supposed to know what it is? I couldn't by my eye just be like, oh, it's that right ankle. And if you can, I think that's, some people maybe have this crazy gift, but I think a lot of people are just guessing at that point.
I guess my question too kind of becomes, you know, at what point do those movement compensations, for lack of a better way to put it, and I hate that term because that kind of implies that there is a correct way to move all the time, period.
Right.
But if we see something that we don't think is normal, then do we correct it or do we let it alone, right? Like some of those broad, you know, overhead type movements, if I have a baseball pitcher, like you mentioned earlier, their throwing arm is probably going to be a lot different overhead than their non-throwing arm.
Yes.
But I don't want to go about correcting that because that's kind of where the sport demand is. It needs to be asymmetrical. So for me to go in and try and correct some of these different asymmetries, I feel like I'm kind of barking up the wrong tree and I'm going to waste someone a lot of time and a lot of money treating something that doesn't even need to be treated.
Right, because we have to go back to what's their goal? Why are they there? What do they need? What is their prerequisites? Like, what are their requirements? Like, if they're just coming in, I go, yeah, your right shoulder moves awesome. Well, your left shoulder doesn't move that well. We need to get up there. But if they're a pitcher, I don't care if their left shoulder has, you know, not as much as their right. That's fine. I mean, is it a major deficit where they can't even get to neutral? Maybe a problem. But if you're like, yeah, you're going to have some sides that are a little bit different, a little bit off. Asymmetry is the biggest thing. We're looking, I hate to say, but I'm always looking for massive deficits or bigger than normal deficits. Like, wow, this is a really, you know, not moving. I'm not sitting there going like, I got my, whatever it's called, the angle measure, and saying, oh, you're 2 degrees off in your right hip compared to your left. That 2 degrees probably doesn't make much of a difference. Now, if we're talking 15 degrees difference, yeah, we have something we're probably going to work with. Otherwise, you know, you can assess somebody, have them come back in 3 days later, and it could be completely different in terms of just small degrees.
And going back to your point on the car as well, I love that, to assess all active movements of a joint in a very short amount of time. Yes. I think everyone knows that evals are usually a time crunch and we're trying to get as much in a short amount of time as possible. I think this is an area where the car really comes in. And I also think your ability to assess so many other movements that we often miss, right? Like how many times do you see a clinician actually assess like knee rotation? And it's like, wait a second, the knee's supposed to rotate? It's just a hinge joint. So I think that your ability to assess these things that are often missed and might go overlooked gives you a huge head up as it relates to you know, your overall clinical approach and outcomes that way. I mean, I think about a lot of the post-op patients I work with, specifically ACL. And it's like, you know, if we have a hamstring graft, considering how the hamstring, you know, it's usually a medial hamstring, how that would internally rotate the knee and what we see at a knee rotation afterwards. Like if I don't have a way to assess that and restore some sense of normalcy, then they're not going to be part of that top third that gets back better than they were before injury that I want them to be in.
Yes. And having that ability to like work with rotation of the knee, right, is sometimes I'm just looking for a pain-free movement to help put more motion in the joint. They might have super painful flexion extension. Like, well, can you rotate? And I can start getting some movement in there, some synovial fluid. Things are starting to feel better. And it's just a lower hanging fruit. And guess what? Now you're learning something different. It's something they can actually see and achieve versus saying, I need you to just bend and extend your knee. And I'm like, well, yeah, no kidding. But we tend to forget that with a lot of joints. Same thing with the elbow, you know, the spine's obviously a little different, but most of our other joints, we got to prioritize some rotation, which I see is overlooked a ton. Maybe now there's that swing the other direction where everyone's just doing tons of rotational. I tend to show more of that because most people, like you said, they have zero idea the knee rotates. Like, oh, really? Yeah, like go ahead and try. And like, oh, that does do that. So it's pretty interesting. Yeah.
No, for sure. And you mentioned before that the cars are great for testing, but you can also give them for mobility maintenance, I think you said. And it's like, what better way to, you know, give someone a very easy home exercise that they can do every single day than something that literally hits every movement in an active, controlled manner. And, you know, there's no equipment required and it's ridiculously challenging. Like, I know people post the videos and they make it look easy, but I've tried to do the shoulder one before and I can't extend my shoulder that well. It's really, right. really hard yeah. once I get up overhead. So it's a really cool line of thought, I think, that allows you to challenge someone in a way that they're probably not normally challenged.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause then you can increase time and retention by how long the rep takes, the weight I'm adding, the body position. If I put you in quadruped versus standing, quadruped challenges it in a different way. So like you said, you can send them home with that and they don't have to have a ton of equipment. They can do it pretty much anywhere, right? It's like, okay, I can get a few of these in throughout my day. And now it's become therapeutic. You're just finding more ways to get movement in. I think that was my biggest thing with this mobility training stuff is like, I can just slot movement into people's days so much easier. And it seems to be the best option for teaching. Like, hey, I need you to go to the gym and do this. And most people aren't even getting into the gym. Let alone using weights at home consistently. You're like, how long does it take you to do 5 shoulder cars? Like, 20 seconds. I'm like, great. How long does it take you to go to the gym and do 5 back squats? Well, I got to get there, do all this stuff. So it's a lower barrier to entry. I don't think everyone has to do mobility training, but I think it's something everyone can do.
Definitely. And, you know, while we've talked a lot about athletes so far, I mean, to your point, I think this applies across the lifespan. You said like 10 to 90. You know, plain and simple, there's, you know, big issue with not moving enough in the older population. And if we can get them to move everything in a very low barrier to entry, full range of motion, active manner, then I think that's a huge win for us.
And a lot of our aging patients, it's called 70 and up, maybe have never even been in a gym before. And they're like, they're intimidated by picking up a weight or a dumbbell or a band. You say, hey, just move your shoulder like this. I can do that. Okay. And then you start teaching them a way to progress it. And, you know, am I trying to get them to do a 5-pound weighted shoulder card? No, I'm just trying to get them to do some to the best of the ability without using as many other, you know, joints as they do. A lot of people take everything else with it, but again, the scalability of it is just so simple. And that's what I really love.
Yeah, definitely. And I think you mentioned the pails and rails as well, progressive and regressive angled isometrics. I think that stands for. And that's another one that fits right under that same umbrella, right? Like, you know, we're literally just pushing or pulling or, you know, not really moving at all. So you can take these anywhere, do them anywhere, and really notice a huge benefit in a very short amount of time. And once again, I found them challenging when I was run through them. Like I was very humbled by how hard they were actually.
Yeah, again, scalability. I can have you do 10% for a long duration up to like, hey, 100% of your maximum voluntary contraction. And we know how therapeutic isometrics are and how well they can be used in so many different cases. And again, that patient just has to get put in that position and then they just contract. Like there's not a lot of external things going on. They're pretty simple to get across. It teaches them to use muscles in ways they haven't. So from a therapist perspective, I use them a lot more in clinic. I don't send people home with them as often. Just because they're a little harder to communicate, I'll usually send people home with like some sort of car rotation, lift off, something like that they can just work on. But pails and rails from a clinical perspective has been super beneficial for me.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. And again, you know, what better way to get someone to buy into what you're doing than provide some kind of manual, you know, intervention to make them feel a little bit better, open up a therapeutic window, and then hit them with something like that, that challenges them, but it challenges them in a different way. As you mentioned, this is not the 5 rep max back squat. This is more of like, you're going to feel an uncomfortable sensation of your body's learning to stabilize in a new position.
Yes. Yes. Agreed.
And I think that's something, as we've been talking about mobility training and that sort of thing, that's something that I also see in place in like a warm-up routine or that sort of thing. Like how many times you go to the gym and everyone just stretches for their warm-up, or, you know, they hit a couple body weight squats for their warm-up. But the same is true in the athletic world, right? Like, you know, I go and I watch a baseball game, and before the game, everyone's, you know, passive hamstring stretching and different things like that. And it's like, you know, are we adequately preparing our athletes for the sport and the task at hand when they go out there? Or maybe is it time that we rethink our warm-up and do something a little bit more than stretching and some basic, you know, active fundamental movements, for lack of a better way to put it?
I think you nailed that. I think we have to go back and say, what does this person need? I call the low-hanging fruit. What do you need to get ready? Do you lack internal rotation in a joint or external rotation in this joint or flexion in this joint? Is it active? Is it passive? What do you need? Make those a few things you're going to do for your warm-up and then get going, right? Then you could do your general stuff, just get heart rate up. But I think people go, well, I got to stretch my hamstrings. I got to do this. I got to do that. I joke with patients, go, how long do you think I spend stretching every day? And they're like, oh, 30, 40 minutes. I go, very few minutes. I go, how long do you think I do mobility every day? They're like, oh, probably like an hour. I go, I integrate in with my workouts and find a couple things I need to work on, but I'm not in the gym every day doing, all right, I need to hit shoulder flexion, extension, internal rotation, external rotation, abduction, adduction. I don't need to do all that. I just need to find out what do I lack or what do I need more of, and then slot that into my training, right? I don't have to do external rotation liftoffs for my shoulder for the rest of my life. I use CARS to see maybe, hey, what do I lack? Or maybe there's some pain, pinch, discomfort, then use that assessment to change what I'm doing. But I think when most people think mobility training, like, oh, I have to put an hour in the gym every day, I don't have time for that. No, what are the couple things you need to do to move the needle and then continue on with your life?
So it almost becomes like a individualized micro dose approach to mobility in that sense. Yes.
Yeah, because I don't have to have everyone doing every single joint mobility every day. I mean, no one has time for that, right? There's very few people. Maybe if you're a high level athlete, sure, you're going to be doing, that's your job. You're going to be doing this stuff all day long because you need to keep your body to, you know, the highest percentage of capabilities you can. But everyday people, man, you just need to find what you need to work on and move better. Like if I have a desk worker, we're probably going to look more in their hips, their low back, their T-spine, stuff like that. You know, am I super crazy about how much ankle dorsiflexion they have? Maybe not right this second. Sure, it could improve. But then you're giving these people, I've seen clinicians give them, here's 20 things I need you to do every day. What's the likelihood they're going to do it? Because we know consistency is the biggest thing when it comes to movement and mobility. As long as you can do this consistently, the dose has to be fairly low every day.
Right. No, I agree. And I think that this is something that could really apply well to the strength and conditioning setting as well. Is a lot of times I hear strength coaches talk to me about, you know, it's very hard to individualize when you've got, you know, a group of 12 or a group of 14 athletes coming in to see you at a time. But it's like, hey, you know, if we just take like 30 seconds before they even come in and get a generalized assessment of how they're moving before we even program, which I think most strength coaches do anyways, most evaluate movement in some capacity. Right. And then it's like, hey, look, if this is challenging, do this and this. Like if X, do Y, like almost like simplify it to the point where you could almost like code it in a computer, for lack of a better way to put it. Like this really simplifies it down to a level that I think anyone could apply it. It's a lot more individualized of an approach. And I think that you'll probably get a pretty positive response, you know, applying that before moving on to some of the different compound movements. Like we've thrown the squat around a few times here. You know, if someone doesn't feel good in the squat and then you do something to make their limited joint move and feel better, they're probably going to respond better when they do squat.
Agreed. And this is something they started working in the FRC, has what's called the internal strength model. It's basically taking this stuff in strength training and blending them together, because who says we can't take a squat and then some sort of mobility training and do it at the same time or superset? Like, why do we have to have them separate, where mobility is always just like this warm-up thing you do, right? And it's kind of a very low level, just lightly move. And then here's all your training, your compound list. Why can't we take them and integrate them? Like, I can have someone do maybe hip capsule work for two sets to almost failure or fatigue. That can be a stimulating movement for their body. It doesn't have to be, hey, I get in the gym and I do a couple hip CARS, that's my mobility, and then I spend 50 minutes doing back squats. You can put them together, and I think it makes it easier for people to do then. Because if you say, everyone's like, oh, I don't have time to do mobility training. What do you mean you don't have time? How long are you in the gym? Like hour and a half. Let's put three movements in between some of your sets. Or let's take out the hamstring curl and let's put in knee flexion work here with hovers and whatnot. It's, you're still training that tissue, but now your reason why is a little bit different.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, on that note too, like if you're someone who, like, you know, hey, today is leg day, I have to hit my leg lifts, period. It's like, okay, but you know, when you're hitting that 2 to 3 minute rest between deadlifts, like Now, if you don't want to touch your legs because it's leg day, hit your shoulder work, your elbow work, even like, you know, we didn't even hit the wrist hand yet, but like a lot of people forget just how important those joints are until they injure them. And then it's like, oh, shoot, I kind of need that for like everything I do ever.
Yeah.
So I think that it's very easy to microdose that in to the workout that way. And I think that there's a fair amount of literature at this point that shows passive stretching while lifting is a bad combo. But I have yet to see anything that bashes active movement while like lifting and loading tissue.
Right. And like you, I don't know, you didn't say it, but you know, as a clinician, that most people only care about their mobility or prehab work once they're hurt, right? Oh, my shoulder's hurt. I'm going to do this stuff. They do great with their rotation stuff. Then they feel great and they go right back to their same things, right? So now we can just take it. Why don't we put that, and I hate to tell people, it's like, you're going to put your rehab stuff in your training. And that's just now what your standard training is. And we see the longevity just be a lot higher, especially in athletes who think like, I just need to squat, deadlift, and bench for my joint health.
Now, they do that stuff because of injury, like you mentioned, but how many of them come back to you later and say, hey, you know, actually, I'm throwing a little bit harder. Hey, you know, when I shoot with lacrosse, I feel like a little more like power coming from my hip now. Like, you know, like,
yeah, that works.
It's interesting because they think about it from a pain and rehab standpoint.
Yes.
But a lot of times we end up seeing performance gains afterwards because we're kind of like addressing that weakest link point, for lack of a better way to put it. And that's probably cliche, but it's like, if we raise the level for that weakest link up higher, everything else is probably going to, you know, perform at the level it could have performed if you didn't have that holding it back.
And that's, as a clinician, it's always hard to tell people like pain is just an indicator, but we, as a society of PTs, chiros, some just focus just on the pain. They go, pain's gone, you're good. Or they don't explain why pain's there. They just try to treat the pain. But realistically, you look, they didn't have motion in that joint. Pain became an issue. We got rid of pain. Well, they still don't have the correct movement in that joint. They go back and their performance isn't great. Even just daily things. Like, they don't have the ability to reach their hand back here. Well, we just soft tissued it away until now pain's not a thing, but they still have the same movement issue. And then they just run that cycle over and over and over. You know, the performance stuff is, I think, the second half of where a lot of people like you and I come in. In terms of treatment is where I think a lot of people are missing that part.
Yeah, no, definitely. Definitely. I think the performance side is really interesting as it relates to mobility. And I think this is an area that, you know, as we hit on before from like the stretching standpoint, there's a lot of misconceptions from a performance standpoint as well, right? Like, plain and simple, you might not need more mobility or more just bigger, faster, stronger type brute strength in order to perform at a higher level. Maybe sometimes we need to get a little bit more technical. I do think you can get too technical, though. I think a lot of times I open up the Instagram and it's like, hey, you know, here's five exercises for this one specific skill for lacrosse or something like that. And it's like, you know, we really don't need five specific things for that one thing. We could be a little bit more generalized, I think.
You're right. And this is where you probably see this. I get a lot of people coming to me and like, they're just lost. They don't know what to do. Do I need to do all these exercises, all this mobility stuff, all this recovery, all like they have only so much time. Like, some of these athletes can only be in the gym for 45 minutes to an hour. And then you're telling them they have to do like all this stuff to warm up, all this stuff to prep their joints, all this stuff to get to where they want to be. And then training happens. They're an hour deep. They're exhausted. They haven't ate enough. And then we're putting too much volume in everything. And I try to, as a clinician, simplify things. Hey, I need you to just go home and do this one or two things. I need you to do this consistently, strip out all this other stuff for a while, and let's just improve it with a smaller dose.
As far as dosage goes for mobility work, where do you kind of like to fall in that sense? Do you go higher volume, lower volume? How do you kind of manipulate the factors around mobility training as far as like the dosage goes?
Yeah, so it depends on what I'm using it for. If it's, hey, you need more daily movement, this joint just needs to be moved more, you can do cars daily. If you're training it, just like you wouldn't train your biceps every single day, maybe you do this two or three times a week, right? If it's higher intensity, you do need time to recover in between. I think a lot of clinicians get it wrong where they do pails and rails, really hard efforts, and they go do this every single day. Well, you wouldn't tell someone to go and back squat max out every single day. We have to sprinkle that in. So it depends on what their goal is. Do I need daily movement? Like, sometimes capsule work, just them rotating their knee. go ahead and do this 3-4 times a day because it's just therapeutic for you to do. It helps get movement in the joint. Now, if I'm training you with a band, a dumbbell, or weight, maybe 2-3 times a week, depending on, again, if I'm saying, hey, I want you to go to fatigue, which is just getting tired, or if I want you to go to failure because we want to really change tissue with it. Again, it all follows under the same stuff with strength training. You know, you don't just tell someone go back squat. You give them maybe rep sets, weights, tempos, whatever it is. You can do the same thing with mobility.
Yeah, and I think it's so funny because we've always thought about mobility, or a lot of people have always thought about mobility in those stretching terms that we talked about earlier, right? Like, hey, I've got to hold this for a minute. Then I got to hold that for a minute, or 30 seconds here, 30 seconds there. And it's so different when we change from that approach over to something more like, hey, we're going to do sets and reps of a mobility drill instead of just hanging out there and holding and letting time pass.
I think a lot of people get frustrated with me. Sometimes I'll give them like, hey, I want you to go do 2 sets to fatigue or 2 sets to failure of liftoff. So like, what do you mean? I go, because if I gave you 3 sets of 10, you get to rep 10 and it's a breeze still. I go, you're not going to change or get better at anything. I need to challenge you. Go, if you can do 15 of these, cool, let's grab a weight. And let's try to find the point where maybe you can only get 5. Well, that's more strength training, right? It, as long as you define what that person's goal is, it makes the prescription of this stuff so much easier. I think a lot of people just go home and do cars, go do these liftoffs, and they come back to you in a week, week and a half, and they're the exact same position you left them in, or maybe a marginal improvement because you didn't give them the right dose or the right stimulus.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think a lot of people too, they look for the stimulus in the wrong areas. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is we talked about stretching, but there's so many other tools out there that people have come to me and they're like, yeah, you know, I do this because I need to move more, or I need more mobility. And it's like, you know, you're sitting on a foam roller for 30 seconds. And it's like, you know, if just sitting on something for 30 seconds made me move more, I would put all my money into it because that's what everyone wants. Yep. But I haven't seen the results that I think a lot of people claim from some of these things, like the foam roller, the barbell smash. Not to say that soft tissue work is bad. I do a lot of it, you know, therapeutically. And I think that there is a very strong time and place for it. It's just, it's probably not doing what we think it's doing.
Yeah, it's a great way to prep the area. It's a great way to, hey, trick the nervous system temporarily to give us more space to train. We as clinicians use it because it takes the stress and energy off the patient. We can do it for them, but then they have to know how to follow it up with some sort of active control. Like, you can stretch all day, you can take the massage gun, it feels great, you get more range of motion, and then you go, what happened 2 hours later? Like, well, it's stiff again. Well, yeah, so you just keep coming in the same thing over and over. Like, if they come to my office and they have the same range of motion in their shoulder every single time, I can get that cool Instagram video showing like, wow, look, they gained 20 more degrees of shoulder rotation. But then every time they come in, they're back at square one. Well, that's not lasting. I don't care then. That means every time you go to warm up, you have to do all this stuff just to get to where you need to be. Wouldn't I want to get you closer to where you don't have to do that much?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I mean, I always love those before and after of like, hey, they came in and day one, they only got to 90. And then here we are, you know, 3 weeks in and now they're at 110, right? Like the lasting change, the lasting impact.
Yes.
I think the acute stuff is needed a lot of times to get people to understand like, hey, this is actually going to provide value. This is something that will work. And I think we need that as clinicians to make sure, hey, you know, we're barking up the right tree here. I do this, I get the result I want.
Yes.
But it takes a little bit longer for it to actually stick and become a more permanent change.
Yeah, and that's the education part. We have to teach them and tell our patients why we're doing this stuff. Most will just say like, oh, look how good your shoulder moves now. They have no idea why. They don't understand what happened, but they just know it moved better. And they know it's because of you. So they think, I can't do that. Now they're like, I need to come in here all the time to do this. Which again, some people build their business off that. I don't have the ability to do that. I don't think it's right to just not tell them what's happening. If they're on board and they understand everything that's happening, you say, hey, I do this to help you, but you can do this to also help yourself. Then we're in the right spot.
Definitely. And it's funny. I think this is a theory of mine. I haven't really seen any like research article to prove it or anything that way, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it. One of my big theories is the imbalance between passive and active range of motion is one of the primary, if not the primary driver of a lot of the injuries we see. In particular, I see a lot of ankle sprains. I see a lot of knee ligament injuries, ACL in particular. And the thought that goes through my head a lot of the times is, you know, I know this is someone I can twist their hip into this position, or I can push them down and get like 65 degrees of plantar flexion at their ankle. And then I test their strength, and it's just limited so much in those positions. You know, for clinicians who might not have learned this in school, instead of just doing your basic MMTs, just change the position of your MMT, right? Like literally move them in 30 degrees of IR, 45 degrees, 60 degrees, and just see how strong they feel to you in those positions. Like, it's so simple. But I think that that imbalance between weakness at those end ranges and the ability to just move there uncontrolled is a huge factor for injury, right? Like, it's basically saying, I can put myself in this, or I can end up in this position, but I have no control over it and no strength there. And if I can't control it from a muscular standpoint, something else that I might not want to take the force is going to. I haven't really seen anything, you know, saying like, this is the biggest predictor, but it's a thought that's just constantly running through my head. Like, hey, could we have prevented some of this? Maybe not all of them, but some of them, if we even just trained this a little bit more, took this a little more seriously.
Dr. Spina hits on this a lot in FRC. It's the sense of, we can mitigate injury of, like, you roll over on your ankle and you weren't strong, or your brain didn't trust that, didn't have the control there. Well, instead of it being a grade 3 sprain, maybe it's now down to a grade 1 because now you're stronger there, right? We can't prevent it, but I can mitigate that, right? Now, instead of you getting in this crazy position, like, you'll see people actually get into the splits. They have no business being there. They're going to tear things. Things are going to get injured. But if they have the strength and control to get out of that position, the likelihood of injury is a lot lower. So that's that gap. And you see, like we said, with younger athletes, flexibility is through the roof. Their control, they don't trust their body. Like, putting their shoulder back here, their brain says, I've never done this. I've never acted here. I don't know how to control that. Well, that's usually where that gap of injury happens. So you're definitely exactly right with that. People get injured in this usually spots that they're not used to being in. And that's the classic ankle inversion. And then as a clinician, we don't rehab ankle inversion again. We just go, well, just stand the Bosu ball and do these cool things. But then what happens when you get back to that position again? People who roll their ankles over and over and over and over, and then they get fear avoidant of being in there. So their body gets that, brain says, I've never been here in a long time. Injury happens.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think you really hit the nail on the head there. And it's so funny that you brought up like the compliant, non-compliant surface, because the amount of times I bash on things like, you know, standing on foam for like ankle strength on here is just astronomical at this point. But I love where your head is at on that. And it's funny too, because I think the opposite is also a misconception as well. There's a lot of who come in and tell me, well, you know, I hear that being tightly wound is better for performance, and the tighter they are, the better. Or, you know, I had a favorite where someone told me that tight hamstrings prevent injuries. And I guess I'm just still trying to wrap my head around some of these different things where, you know, we know that movement is important. We know that compensations can be okay, cannot be okay, depending on the situation. But then we also have some that kind of say like, no, I want them tight. I don't want them to be able to move. And it's like, I guess I just can't quite understand that from an injury prevention standpoint or really a performance standpoint.
I think because parents believe, and they've been taught by some coaches and strength coaches, that the stronger they are, the less likelihood they are to get injured. They think strength is the direct predictor of injury. So you see these kids back squat and they have a 200, 300 pound back squat, but they're going a third of the way down, half the way down, but they got that big number. So they're strong. They shouldn't get injured. But like Joey Burgles does this stuff the best. All his athletes go full range of motion. They teach him a good deep squat, single leg knee flexion stuff. They learn these full range control things. Just because you're strong does not mean you're not going to get injured, but they think, okay, just limit that range of motion. But, you know, little Billy here can bench press 200 pounds. That's great, but his shoulder can't move, right? So it doesn't matter. But they think as parents, that's what they've been taught. They trust these coaches. And we both know too, that halftime these coaches in these positions don't have the credentials. They're someone's parent that says, I'm going to be the coach. This is what I did when I was your age. We just benched and squatted. They don't think of it from like a clinician standpoint. I think that's where you and I really benefit, is we're taking strength conditioning, our background in sports, and now clinical expertise, and blending that all in for these kids.
Is there ever a time where you would purposely limit the motion into that like top middle third of the rep and avoid the end range, or not really?
Maybe if it's like pain is an issue or they're super unstable and we need them to just get the stimulus of a heavy weight. But at the same time, we're working that other range of motion, maybe with less weight, or as long as they're paired together. Right. Yeah. I have some people, maybe I only have them do a quarter squat. because I'm doing something sports specific for them, but then I have to take the rest of that squat range of motion in some way or capacity and find other exercises to support that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I love that. I do the same thing myself. And this is actually one of my favorite ways to, I superset a lot in my sessions. I know everyone's like, wait, you're a PT or you rehab. And it's like, well, we can still do supersets or tri-sets, but I will literally break down the movement. Say I'm looking at the knee and I just want to take it from max flexion to extension closed chain. Well, maybe I can hit the top 90 degrees with a barbell lunge. Great. Yeah. But what about the other, 40, 50 degrees? Well, then maybe I put the barbell back on the rack, have them elevate their foot maybe 6-8 inches on a box. And now we do a real deep tier and hit the more deeper range in eflection there.
Exactly. So
same movement pattern.
Yep.
Different ranges. And slightly different load too, because, I think the other piece that we might not have brought up yet is your tissues, your muscles are, they have different strengths based on where you're at in the motion, right? Like if you're doing a bicep curl, there's going to be a certain point where you're curling that weight and you're like, all of a sudden, this is so easy. It's supposed to be that way.
Right.
So if I want to hit different ranges, I might need to load you a little bit differently depending on where we're at in the motion.
I agree. That's why the joint training stuff, I fell in love with that so much, because I'm like, I can take you and put you to end range elbow flexion or end range extension. Now work that in range motion, which once we start getting fatigued, we easily cut out our end ranges, right? Like a bicep curl, a lot of people, they start getting fatigued, they don't go to full extension, because going from full extension that first few degrees is the hardest part of the movements when the muscle is fully lengthened. They start to cheat those reps, bench press, squat, same thing. You never see a kid when they get more fatigued go lower on the rep. They always stop just a little bit higher, a little bit higher, a little bit higher. So we have to break that down, be like, let's fill in the rest of that range of motion.
Yeah, definitely. Kyle, I feel like we covered a lot of ground as it relates to mobility work and athletic performance and so on that way today. Is there anything we missed as we were talking, or any other thoughts that you have?
The biggest thing I like to hit with people is don't be afraid of mobility training thinking you have to do a ton of it, right? I think a small dose is more than enough for most people. And it doesn't have to be, every single day, or I have to every range of motion possible. People just think it's the separate entity and I have to do this all by itself, 45 minutes a day, 5 minutes of mobility work. And I'm now even trying to make people understand that mobility doesn't mean I'm getting on the ground, stretching and rolling around. It can literally be your strength training stuff. You're now doing your back squat, but now you're going a full deep back squat, tons of knee flexion, holding for a minute, get back up. Maybe that's your kind of mobility work. Maybe you just need to break down one joint and do it. So my whole goal is just try to get people to understand it's not this black and white end all be all. You either do it or you don't. You can find ways to put it into your daily life.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's essential to start working this in for everyone, because, myself included, I probably spend too much time sitting down. I probably don't move enough and I'm probably tight in different areas. So it's the more I stay on top of it now, the better off I'm going to be for the long haul.
Yes. And you get a lot of people come in their 30s, 40s, 50s, like, man, I wish I did this earlier. Man, I wish I spent more time on it, because it is true. The less you move that joint, the more stiff, tight, painful it's going to get. And it does take work when we're trying to make a change. But if you stay ahead of it, if you move your neck all the way back 3 times a week versus 0 times for years on end, you're going to maintain that. People only really get old when they stop moving. You see the populations, they're out there gardening, biking, walking. They don't all of a sudden become that hunched over person. They can still move, and society is just getting us to move less and less. So we have to be more active and proactive to move a little bit more.
I completely agree. Kyle, I know you're constantly posting amazing stuff about all this online as well. Where can people find you at as far as social media goes?
My big one's Instagram, drkyle.richmond. I post all my content there. I post a reel every single day now dude, we're coming up on a year and 8 months or something like that.
Posting goodness.
That was one of my keys to success with my growth on social media, which I'm super blessed to have the platform I do. Slowly trying to get into YouTube and other things, but Instagram is where, if people have questions, I always recommend reach out. If I can't help you, I'll find the person that can, or at least get you in the right path. If you have any questions, Instagram is my big one.
For sure. We'll link to that in the description below there as well. Kyle, I really appreciate your time today, man. Thanks for everything.
I appreciate you. Thank you.